You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 191 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Understanding Society Through Spiritual Scientific Knowledge, Social Threefolding, Christ, Lucifer, and Ahriman. 15 lectures, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 4, given in Dornach on the 10th of October, 1919. Over these days, I want to explore some of the aspects of what is needed, firstly, to comprehend, and secondly, to act practically within society today. It is fairly easy to see from ubiquitous and salient facts that our modern civilization shows symptoms of decline, that there are forces of decline at work in it, and that in the face of this, we need to consider how to endow this civilization with new forces. If we survey this civilization of ours, we can primarily discern three kinds of decline, three forces that must, over time, inevitably lead to its downfall. All the dismal occurrences we have already experienced in the course of humanity's evolution and are still experiencing, and some of them are only in their infancy, are just diverse symptoms of the overall phenomenon of decline occurring in our era. If we expand our view beyond what is happening at present in society today, and in the last 3 to 4 centuries, and consider the larger course of human evolution, it can become apparent that older cultures had a foundation, also in their daily life and existence, that nowadays we only wrongly believe we possess. These ancient cultures, especially pagan ones, had a certain scientific character. People were aware that something of the whole universe lived in their souls. You need only think how alive still were the worlds of thought of the Greeks. Their conception of the world of gods and spirits beyond mundane reality and behind the sense world. And you need only recall something that vividly entered into the daily life of those times and gave these people of ancient cultures a certain connection with a world of spirit of which they were aware. In everyday life, the people of these ancient cultures certainly knew they stood within a world that is not limited to mundane experience alone, but into which spirit beings work. Daily actions were undertaken under the promptings of spiritual powers. Thus, especially, if we look back to pagan cultures, we find a certain fundamental scientific tone, which we can describe as a cosmogony, or sense of cosmic connection. In other words, people then knew themselves to be a part of the whole cosmos, not simply lost beings that gambol about here on the earth's green grass like lambs, but connected with the whole broad span of the universe, which shaped their destiny. There is no real impetus in our civilization to create cosmic connection. We do not have a genuinely scientific way of thinking, in the true sense of the word. We itemize the diverse facts of nature, and we have a conceptual framework of ideas, but not a genuine science that connects us with worlds of spirit. The science cultivated today and affecting our daily life is very impoverished compared to the powers of the world of spirit that a person in ancient times knew were pulsing through him as he acted. He had a cosmogony. he knew he was membered into the whole universe. He looked up to sun, moon, and stars not as to alien worlds, but recognized his inmost affinity with them. Thus ancient civilizations possessed a cosmogony, which our civilization has lost. A person cannot be strong in life without this. That is the first thing driving the decline of our civilization, what you might call the scientific element. The second element, driving its decline, is the lack of a real impulse for freedom. Our civilization lacks the capacity for comprehensively establishing freedom. Although many speak of freedom, only a few people today have a real idea of what it means, and still fewer gain a true inner impulse toward it. In consequence, our civilization gradually succumbs to something that cannot possibly sustain it, to fatalism. Either we have a religious fatalism, where people give themselves up to religious powers of one kind or another, offering themselves in its service as if they were puppets on strings pulled by these greater powers. Or we have a scientific fatalism. This comes to expression in a gradually developing view that everything is governed by natural necessity, or economic necessity, which allows no room for freedom of action. When people feel harnessed by the economic or the scientific world, fatalism is the only word for it. Or, as I said, we have the fatalism accompanying modern religious confessions, which really also excludes freedom. There are many hearts and souls today who would best like to give themselves up to what Christ or some other spiritual power may do with them. In fact, a frequent objection to anthroposophy is that we do not place enough value on being redeemed by Christ, but instead seek to redeem ourselves. People wish to be led, governed. Really, they want fatalism to be true. And in the recent years of misfortune, one has often heard people asking why God or Christ does not help a particular nation. Surely, they believe, there must be divine justice, and they want this divine justice to be meted out, enacted as fate, instead of being inwardly empowered by the impulse of freedom. A civilization unable to cultivate this impulse of freedom weakens people and condemns them to decline. That is the second thing. The lack of a sense of cosmic connection is the first, and the lack of a real impulse for freedom, the second, of the powers of decline at work in our civilization. And the third is that our civilization is unable to produce any new impulse for true religious feeling and will. Really, it only wants to continue to cultivate the old confessions, keep warming them up again. Our civilization lacks the strength to bring new religious impulses to life, and it lacks the strength also for really altruistic action. A strong altruistic impulse can only come from a spiritual worldview. Only when we know ourselves to be a part of the world of spirit do we cease to be so terribly interesting to ourselves as to make ourselves the very center of the whole universe. At that point, egoistic impulses cease and altruistic ones begin. Our era has little inclination to develop this great interest for the world of spirit, but this is what must increase if we are really to feel ourselves part of the spiritual world. And then, the impulses of reincarnation and karma have, as it were, come raining into our civilization out of the blue. Yet, how have they been taken up? Even those who embrace them have done so in a very egoistic fashion. It has been said, for example, that a person earns his destiny in each life. Even otherwise intelligent people can be heard to say that ideas of reincarnation and karma are an answer to the question of why human suffering exists, and the social question is therefore irrelevant. Otherwise intelligent people have said that poverty is the deserved outcome of a former incarnation, that if someone is poor, they must simply expiate something they brought about in their past life. So even ideas of reincarnation and karma are not capable of working into our civilization as an impulse for altruistic feeling. What matters is how we introduce ideas of reincarnation and karma into our era. If they only become an impetus for egoism, they do not raise our culture to a higher level, but push it still further downward. Reincarnation and karma actually become unethical or anti-ethical ideas if many people think they must become good so that their next incarnation is a good one. This drive to become good in order to have as pleasant an experience as possible in our next life is a kind of double egoism, a step beyond even straightforward egoism. And this is precisely what ideas of reincarnation and karma have come to mean for many. Our society today has so little real altruism and religiosity that it cannot even comprehend ideas such as reincarnation and karma in a way that would make them an impulse for altruistic and not egoistic actions and feelings. These three things, therefore, make up the forces of decline in our culture: the lack of a cosmogony, the lack of a real foundation for freedom, and the lack of altruistic feeling. Where there is no real sense of cosmic connection, no true science exists either, no real knowledge. Knowledge ultimately becomes a kind of cosmic or cultural diversion or pastime, and has largely become so in our civilization, except where it is a purely utilitarian moment in outward culture, external technological culture. In our era, freedom has become little more than a phrase, since our civilization lacks the strength to found and establish it thoroughly, and hence to spread its impulse. Nor, in the economic realm, do we have the capacity to progress in a truly social sense, since our civilization has no altruistic impulses, but only egoistic, thus anti-social ones, and these anti-social impulses can never enhance social abilities. You see, truly social dynamics depend on creating a structure in society in which one person acts in the interests of another. Can we see this happening anywhere in our civilization? The whole social order is founded on each person acting only for himself, and everything is geared to this. So, how can we progress beyond these symptoms of our civilization's decline? We can't whitewash over them. Let us look these realities in the face and avoid all illusions. The powers of decline are here, and there is no point in thinking we might somehow fix things, repair the problem. Against the forces of degeneration that we have described, we must turn to something from which we can draw regenerative powers. Theories cannot help. People can invent the finest theories, the best principles, but they will get us nowhere. We will only get somewhere by invoking powers that really exist on this earth. If this civilization were only as I have described it, we could do nothing other than let it go under and share in this downfall. And this is because it is absurd to attempt to correct the symptoms through mere ideas. But is there, perhaps, a deeper cause of social ills? There is indeed. People today, as I have often characterized from other angles, are too driven toward the absolute. In asking about truth, they want to know what is an absolute truth, and not what applies to a particular era. When they ask what is good, they mean this in an absolute sense, not what is good for Europe or for Asia, not what is good for the 20th century or the 25th. This urge for absolute goodness and truth prevents them from inquiring into humanity's actual, tangible evolution. But we must ask the question differently. Look at actual reality, and in accordance with it, ask a different question, often in a way that elicits apparently paradoxical answers compared to the views which a superficial observation of things inclines us to. We must ask this: is it possible to develop a cosmological way of thinking again? Is it possible to develop a truly socially effective impulse for freedom? Is it possible to develop an impulse that is simultaneously a religious and a fraternal one, and therefore provides a true foundation for an economic social order? And if we ask these questions with a true eye to reality, we will also find real answers. You see, the important thing is this: that in the modern world, not all of humankind is disposed to arrive at the whole comprehensive truth. Across the globe, different branches of the human race are disposed to arrive at partial areas of truth and its practical realization. So where, in the modern world, can a cosmogony develop? Where can the impulse of freedom really come into its own? And where does an impulse exist to develop religious and fraternal social community? If we start with the latter, unprejudiced appraisal of our global circumstances shows that an outlook, a mode of thinking that cultivates a truly fraternal impulse on earth, is to be found amongst the people of Asia, especially in Chinese and Indian culture. Although these cultures have already succumbed to decadence, and although what I say seems to contradict a superficial assessment, it is in these regions that we can discern impulses of love proceeding from the inmost human heart toward all other beings. And only this can provide the foundations for religious altruism, firstly, and secondly, for a truly altruistic economic culture. But the curious thing is this: although the Asiatic peoples have a disposition for altruism, they do not have the means to realize it. They have the right stance or outlook for it, but not the capacity, the talent, if you like, to create conditions in which the beginnings of altruism could be outwardly realized. For millennia, the Asiatic peoples knew how to cultivate altruistic impulses in human nature. And yet, they also made it possible for great hunger and destitution to be rampant in China, India, and elsewhere. This is the curious thing about Asiatic culture: that the disposition is there, that it is also inwardly authentic. Yet there is no talent for realizing this outlook in outward life. Inwardly, it possesses a hugely significant altruistic impulse, but no capacity to realize this outwardly. On the contrary, if Asia were to remain alone, the fact that Asia has an inner capacity to develop altruism, but no gift for outwardly realizing it, would lead to a terrible devastation of civilization. Of these three things, the impulse for cosmic connection, the impulse for freedom, and the impulse for altruism, Asia has the latter most of all in its inner outlook and disposition. and yet it has only one-third of what modern civilization needs, if it is to pursue an upward path again, the inner disposition for altruism. And what does Europe have? It has the most urgent need to solve the social question, but it has no inherent disposition to do so. Really, it would need the Asiatic outlook if it wished to solve the ills of society. Social imperatives mean that all the preconditions exist in Europe for solving the social question. But to do so, Europeans would first have to imbue themselves with the way of thinking that comes naturally to those in Asia, who, however, have no talent for really outwardly perceiving social misery. In fact, this often even pleases them. In Europe, there exists an outward impulse to deal with social problems, but without the inner disposition to do so. On the other hand, Europeans have, to the greatest degree, a talent, a capacity to establish the impulse for freedom. Specifically, European talents exist to develop and configure the inner feeling of freedom in the most eminent sense. We can say that coming to a real idea of freedom is a specific European gift. But there is no one amongst these Europeans able to act freely, to realize freedom. Europeans are magnificent at comprehending the idea of freedom, but just as the Asiatic peoples would immediately know what to do if they acquired the unsullied idea of European freedom, without other European disfigurements, so the European can elaborate the loveliest idea of freedom, but without any political means of directly realizing it amongst the peoples of Europe. And this is because the European only has one of the three conditions for civilization, the urge for altruism, for freedom, for cosmic connection. He only has the impulse for freedom, without the other two. And therefore, he has only a third of what is needed to really bring about a new era. It is very important for us to finally start to understand these matters as the secrets of our civilization. In Europe, we may say, we have the finest preconditions for thoughts and feelings about freedom, but no means to advance this freedom. For instance, at a time when all Germany was suffering under the tyranny of Ludendorff and others, there were people who composed the finest essays on freedom. In Europe, we have a talent for conceiving the impulse of freedom, but at present, this impulse is only a third, and not the whole, of what is needed if our civilization is really to surmount its problems. We do not understand the secrets of our civilization today if we do not know how to apportion the three impulses involved in the resurgence of our civilization to the different regions of the globe. If we do not know that a quest for cosmic connection lies in the talents of the Anglo-American world, that the quest for freedom is inherent in the European world, and that the quest for altruism and for an outlook which, when truly applied in reality, leads to socialism, is found only in Asiatic culture. America, Europe, Asia. Each has a third of what is needed for a real resurgence, a rebuilding of our culture. Anyone who earnestly and honestly seeks to help rebuild civilization today must draw on these foundations. It is no good nowadays sitting in an ivory tower and reflecting on what the best program for the future might be. You have to go out into the world and draw from it the impulses that exist there. As I have said, if you look at our culture today with its symptoms of decline, inevitably you will gain a sense that it is beyond salvation. Unless people acknowledge that the three things needed are present in different regions unless they start to collaborate with each other more broadly across the earth and recognize that one region alone does not have the inner absolute resources to accomplish this. Each must contribute the gifts to which it is, if you like, predestined. If Americans today wish to draw on their own resources to develop not only cosmic connection, but also freedom and socialism, they cannot do so. Nor can Europeans, besides establishing the inner impulse of freedom, also find cosmic connection and altruism. Likewise, people in Asia cannot realize anything other than the altruism deeply inherent in them. We will only make real progress if other populaces of the globe adopt this same altruism and penetrate it with the element that is their own inherent gift. Humanity today needs to collaborate across the globe in order for its different talents to come together. We have to acknowledge that our civilization has grown weak and needs to strengthen once again. To give a more tangible sense of these abstract things, I'll say the following. As you know, the ancient pre-Christian Oriental cultures created great cities. We can look back to widespread Oriental cultures with their magnificent cities. But a certain outlook reigned there, in the great cities of all Oriental cultures, an outlook developed that if human beings did not reach beyond the physical to the superphysical realm, they would live in a void, in a nothingness. And this is really how the great cities of Babylon, Nineveh, and so forth could develop, because the people living there were not constrained to think that what these cities produced was truly real. For them, reality lived behind all this. Not until Rome did city culture become the standard of reality. The Greek cities are inconceivable without the countryside surrounding them, which nourished and sustained them. If our history were not the fable convenu that it is, a story we have agreed upon, but if instead it conveyed to us the real shape of former times, we would see how the Greek city was rooted in the land. Rome was no longer rooted in the surrounding land in this way. Rome's history involves making an imaginary world into a real one, turning an unreal world into reality. In Rome, really, the citizen was invented, this ghastly caricature beside the true human being. You see, the human being is a human being, and that he is also a citizen, too, is an imaginary matter. That he is a citizen is a fact found somewhere in church statutes or legal statutes. Apart from being a human being with certain intrinsic capacities, he is accorded a registered property, an entry in the land register. And all this is Roman, an imaginary addition alongside reality. Indeed, Rome achieved a great deal more, too. Rome learned how to falsely convert into reality everything that arises from the separation of the cities from the land's reality. For instance, Rome was able to introduce Roman legal concepts into ancient religious ideas. If you look back to the ancient religious ideas and examine their actual nature, you will find nothing in them of the Roman legal terms that later infiltrated them. Roman jurisprudence pervaded religious ethics. What Rome made of religious ethics is basically as if there were judges seated on high in the supersensible world, like the judges that sit in our own Roman-influenced law courts, who passed judgment on human actions. Indeed, because Roman legal concepts still influence us, whenever anyone mentions karma, most people who acknowledge such a thing imagine it to be dispensed by some law of justice in a world beyond, rewarding what a person has done in this way or that, with this punishment or that, in line with earthly concepts and in accordance with a Roman view of justice. In such ideas, all saints and supersensible beings embody Roman legal concepts that have seeped through into this super-terrestrial world. Who today, for instance, still comprehends the great idea of Greek fate? We cannot understand a figure such as Oedipus in terms of Roman legal concepts. Under the influence of these ideas, founded on Roman jurisprudence, in fact, people have entirely lost the gift for comprehending tragic greatness. These legal ideas from Rome have infiltrated our modern civilization and live there everywhere, have largely created a false reality from what was at first imaginary, not imaginative, but imaginary. We have to be very clear, therefore, that we are sundered from reality in our thoughts and ideas, and that we need to re-imbue them with reality. Since our concepts are basically empty, our civilization still lacks the awareness that people must work together across the globe. Views remain superficial, and no one really wants to look at the underlying cause of phenomena. I'd like to give you an example of this too. As you know, two parties evolved in the various parliaments of the world in former times, let us say in the first half of the 19th century, and somewhat later, a conservative and a liberal party. And so far these have enjoyed a fairly high level of respect. Other parties only emerged later, in addition to these original two. But listen, it is so important today that we get beyond phrases to realities, and that instead of always asking what those who represent a party say about their policies, we examine what lies in their subconscious. If you do this, you find that those who belong to more conservative parties have more to do in some way with agricultural concerns, with care of the land and soil, that is, the founding origins of human culture. Of course, all sorts of other secondary factors can appear on the surface as well. I am not saying that every conservative has to be an agriculturalist, for of course all sorts of other people join these parties, people who, persuaded by mere phrases, adhere to some principle or other. But all in all, we can see that those who are interested in maintaining certain structures and forms of the social order, as they are, and not allowing them to slip too suddenly away from them, are people who belong to the agrarian population. Liberal, progressive movements emerge from the industrial element, from labor that has become more sundered from the land. Thus, these two types of party are rooted in something deeper, and we should always try to go beyond the phrases they utter, delve beyond words into actual realities. And ultimately, all these things tell us that we have been living very much in a culture of words, instead of which we must work our way forward to a culture of reality, a civilization of realities. No longer being so impressed by words, programs, well-formulated objectives, we must come to the point of understanding reality, and above all realities that go deeper than either rural or city culture, agrarian or industrial culture. And a deeper aspect today lies in the impulses of different parts of humanity across the globe, of American culture in its quest for cosmogony, of European culture in its quest for freedom, of Asiatic culture in its quest for socialism. However, such quests have been realized initially in some curious ways. Anglo-American culture is conquering the world. As it does so, it is essential that it assimilates what it can from the parts of the world it conquers, impulses of freedom, altruistic impulses. For it, only possesses the impulse of cosmic connection. It owes its success to the capacity to think in universal thoughts, as we have frequently discussed during the war years. The successes of Anglo-American culture have arisen from certain kinds of super-sensible impulse which other cultures refuse to comprehend. This element of cosmogony must not remain isolated, but must interpenetrate with the realm of freedom. To understand what this means, we naturally have to distance ourselves radically from mere phrase-mongering and instead reach realities. If you cling to phrases, you will of course say that in recent years the Anglo-American world has been at the forefront of the impetus for freedom. It has, of course, in terms of copious words. But what is important is how things are in reality, not how they are propounded in words. As you know, I have repeatedly had to speak of the phrase-mongering of Wilsonism, which has long been spreading across the Western world. From October 1918 onward, in fact, it even took hold in Central Europe. The illusion of empty phrases did not endure for long here, but it did take hold for a while. I had to keep pointing it out, and I recall a small movement emerging in response to my frequent reiteration of how empty, abstract, and futile was everything related to the name of Woodrow Wilson. But even in America itself now, people are, in a small way, beginning to see through the vacuity and abstract nature of Wilsonism. Here, it was not a matter of turning the people as such against Woodrow Wilson, of European antagonism to his project, but rather, it was an antagonism that emerged from insight into the powers at work in our civilization. I wanted to characterize Wilsonism as the embodiment of abstract thinking of the most unreal kind. Wilsonist thinking has exerted such a one-sided influence because it assimilated the American impulse without really possessing the impulse of freedom. Just talking about freedom is no proof that the freedom impulse is really present. Or the impulse of true altruism. The life of Central Europe is out for the count, has more or less sunk into a terrible sleep. At present, Germans are compelled to think of freedom, not to think of it merely in fine phrases as happened when people were sighing under Ludendorff's unfreedom. Urgent need, of course, brings to light some real understanding of the idea of freedom. But with souls and bodily forces lamed, with the impossibility of people really bestirring themselves to think keenly. In Germany we have all kinds of attempts to create democratic structures, but no democrats. We have a republic, but no republicans. All this is a phenomenon that emerges very especially as a characteristic of Central Europe. And turning to Eastern Europe, the proletariat of the whole world has been praising the fruitfulness of Marxism. Lenin and Trotsky were able to put Marxism into practice, which has been plundering civilization, and signifies its downfall. And we're only at the beginning of these things. Nevertheless, in Europe, there lives a gift for ideally, spiritually establishing freedom. This Europe must truly enlarge itself by collaborating with the other peoples of the earth. In Asia, we can see the ancient Asiatic spirit dawning again. The leading cultural personalities in Asia, you need only think of the example of Rabindranath Tagore, reveal in their whole manner of speaking that the old altruistic spirit is not dead. But there is now less possibility than there was in earlier times of achieving civilization through this third, only, of human civilizing impulses. Because of all this, people today speak of so many things that really belong to the culture of decline, but they represent them as some kind of ideal. For years we have heard it proclaimed that every nation must have the means to live in some way, I really don't know how, that accords with its own nature, or something similar. But now let me ask you this. What is a nation for people today, if they are honest? In reality, it's just a phrase, not a reality. One can speak of a nation, of a people, if one speaks of a folk spirit, as Anthroposophy does, when this is founded on an underlying reality, but not when something purely abstract is meant. And those who speak of the freedom of peoples and so on are speaking in the abstract, for they do not believe in the reality of a national spirit or character. Here lies the deep inner untruth to which people pay homage. To have no belief in the reality of the national spirit, and yet to speak of the freedom of the nation as if this nation were a reality for modern materialistic people. What is the German people? 90 million people that can be enumerated one by one. People do not believe in any self-contained nation as such, and yet they speak of these things and think they are talking about realities, while all the time they are lying to themselves. By contrast, it is a reality to identify in Anglo-American culture a quest for cosmic connection, in European culture a quest for freedom, in Asiatic culture a quest for altruism. And now we should attempt to comprehend these three partial forces within a cosmic consciousness, and drawing on this consciousness to say that the old culture, striving out of its partial element, must go under, and that to seek to sustain it really means to act counter to one's time rather than in harmony with it. A new civilization is needed and must arise upon the ruins of the old. The ruins of the old are shrinking before our gaze, and we only properly understand our time if we have the will and the courage for something new. But what is new should not come from a merely Grecian or Roman sense of nation, nor from the global consciousness of modern people, but from a cosmic consciousness of a future humanity, in which we gaze upward from the earth again to the cosmos. And this cosmos must not be seen in the merely Copernican or Galilean terms. The Europeans learned to see Earth's place in the cosmos in terms of mathematics, but they failed to acquire a true science and knowledge of this cosmos. In his own day, Giordano Bruno was certainly a great figure, a great individual, but today we need an awareness that where he saw only mathematical order, in fact, a spiritual order reigns. The American does not intrinsically believe in a merely mathematical universe. From within his civilization, he strives for knowledge of supersensible forces, albeit on a mistaken path. In Europe, people learned to pursue all kinds of knowledge. But when Goethe characteristically asked what the nature of knowledge is, no further progress was made, and this was because Europe proved unable to enlarge its findings, for instance, about the human being, into a greater cosmogony. Goethe discovered metamorphosis, the metamorphosis of plants, of animals, of humans. In his view of the skeletal system, the head is a transformed spine and spinal cord. This is a fine discovery. But all this must be developed further into an awareness of the fact that this head embodies the transformed human being from a last incarnation, while our limbs are a preparation for a subsequent incarnation. True science must be cosmic or will otherwise not be worthy of the name. without incorporating the cosmos as a cosmogony. Science cannot provide us with inner human impulses that sustain us through our lives. In today's world, we cannot any longer live instinctively. We have to become conscious. We need a cosmogony and we need true freedom. We do not just need phrases about it, mere talk on the subject of freedom, but a real incorporation of freedom into our immediate existence. And this can only come about on paths that lead to ethical individualism. And it was, of course, characteristic that the moment my book titled The Philosophy of Freedom was published, Edward von Hartmann, who was one of the first to receive a copy of the book, wrote to me to say that the book should have a different title, not The Philosophy of Freedom, but, quote, Epistemological Phenomenology and Ethical Individualism, close quote. Well and good. It would have been a long-winded title, certainly, but not bad to call it Ethical Individualism. Ethical individualism is nothing other than a personal realization of freedom. The best people simply fail to grasp that something such as I was urging in The Philosophy of Freedom was drawn from the actual needs and impulses of the time. And if we look toward Asia, then Asia and Europe need to learn to understand each other. But if things continue as they have been, they will never do so. Asians look toward America and see that really there is only a kind of external mechanism of life at work there, of the state, of politics, and so forth. The Asiatic does not have a sense for these outward mechanisms, but only for what emerges from the inmost impulses of the human soul. And the Europeans have to some degree concerned themselves with the nature of Asiatic spirituality. But so far, one can say without much understanding. Nor have they come to unified agreement. And the way in which they have been at mutual odds has shown they did not know how to incorporate the real impulses of Asiatic culture into European culture with any understanding. Think of Blavatsky. She sought to introduce all kinds of aspects of Indian and Tibetan culture into Europe. In another way, Max Müller tried to bring Asiatic culture to Europe. There are things in Blavatsky that are lacking in Max Müller, and vice versa. Simply in the judgment Max Müller has made about Blavatsky, we can see how little real mutual engagement there has been. Max Müller thought that Blavatsky failed to bring a true Indian spirituality to Europe, but only an imitation of it. He offers this metaphor. If people were to see a pig that just grunts, they would scarcely be surprised. But if they saw a pig that speaks like a person, they would be astonished indeed. What he meant by this, surely, was that he, with his version of Asiatic culture, was grunting like a pig, whereas Blavatsky was like a pig uttering human speech. It seems to me, though, that it is not of much interest when a pig grunts, but that it would awaken a good deal of interest if a pig suddenly ran about talking human language. The metaphor itself shows the search for a comparison that very much remains in the sphere of phrase-mongering. But people today pay no heed to this. And if one accentuates the genuinely ridiculous aspect of such a statement, they object to the impropriety of doing so in regard to an acknowledged authority such as Max Müller. But the time has come to speak honestly and without dissembling. To do so requires us to place the secrets of civilization fairly and squarely before people. Anglo-Americanism has the gift for cosmic connection. Europe has the gift for freedom. Asia has the gift for altruism, for religion, for a fraternal socio-economic order. These three dispositions must merge for all humanity. We must become people of the cosmos and act from this standpoint, and then what the times really require can eventually arrive. The end of Lecture 4.